remember one thing my parents used to say is that there's never going to be a good time to have kids. You're never going to say, oh, this is the perfect time to have kids. At least that was their point of view. And that was their way of saying, like, when it happens, when it presents itself, you just do it and you figure it out. So I kind of had that, you know, in the back of my head, but still I was panicking. Just talking about it is like, I can almost bring it back up, you know? And I also just thought, how am I going to survive?
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today, I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with entrepreneur and producer Matt Wedburn. Matt is a co-founder and CEO of ESP Presents, where he manages event production, technical and creative direction, as well as brand activation for the company and its new venue space, Exchange 312. Matt is a serial entrepreneur, event producer, connector, and self-described social concierge whose personal interests directly reflect his professional endeavors. Matt is dad to his daughters, ages 8 and 9. In this episode, Matt talks about riding the waves of his father's entrepreneurial pursuits and how inspiring and intimidating it was to witness his parents' constant hustle. He explains how a childhood in sunny SoCal, full of thrash metal, BMX, and skateboarding, exposed him to Hollywood's behind-the-scenes trades and eventually led him to film school in Chicago. We talk about how he lucked out and launched a hip-hop recording studio in his early 20s and went on to parlay those experiences and connections into countless ventures in film, music, video, and special events. We talk at length about what it means to create experiences and memories for his daughters, born just 14 months apart, and how his divorce and commitment to co-parenting continues to reshape life, work, and the example he and his ex-wife set for their girls.
It just happens that, you know, the summer comes and goes, and then you realize, wow, it's September, it's October, it's the fall. I guess that's where we are. So, you know, just things move fast. Like Ferris Bueller said, if you don't stop and look around, it might just pass you by.
That's right. That's right.
So
kids are back in school.
Yeah. And that's also a big signifier, you know. It's like, well, at least for me, I'm like, what's their big memory of this summer? What's the takeaway? What was the big thing we got to do? And I don't know why I put that pressure on myself, but I'm just always thinking about what memories they're going to have to take away, because I guess that's how I look at everything in life.
Yeah, man. I feel like learning and memory making are really the only thing that I can justify spending a lot of money on.
Yeah.
Everything else is just sort of stuff and loses its shine almost as soon as you get it, you know?
Yeah.
But an opportunity to make memories, or like you said, like, what's the big takeaway from this summer? Like investing in that, it always seems worthwhile afterwards, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those are the things I remember about my childhood, is that time we went to the Grand Canyon or Redwood National Forest or saw the Golden Gate Bridge or drove through the plains where I had no idea where we were, but it was different. Those things stick with you. So
yeah,
it's important to me that we get to do something like that, even if it's small, just a change of scenery. Because there's so much to learn and travel, and it's a different perspective and see different people that you don't see every day. It's so huge, especially for them.
Yeah, no doubt. You'd mentioned childhood memories and travel, and it seems like a good starting point for this conversation and kind of talking about your upbringing and your own father or father figures that you had growing up. Can you tell me about those relationships?
Sure. Well, if we go all the way back, my father was an entrepreneur. You know, his co-pilot and VP or whatever, I don't think they had titles, was my mother. My dad was in computers. He was an engineer and programmer. He was really into the hardware and obviously the software to make it go. And he had multiple jobs at banks. Like, that was actually what kept moving him around, is he was working with the World Bank. And as that entity was growing, it was the forefront of technology and was trying to push boundaries there in that field. So my dad was learning and making it up as he went. And that was kind of the era of computer technology at the time anyways, in the 70s and 80s. So we end up in Southern California. My dad is the lead, my mother supporting him, and pretty much the household, you know, was her domain. And she was a real boss, real powerhouse. And if I kind of fast forward through life in Southern California, it was awesome as a kid because you honestly felt like you couldn't live in a better place to be able to play outdoors and ride bikes, skateboard, go to the beach, play in the sprinklers, whatever. It was just what you did for play was always outside. And then the side of my dad that I got to experience because he was doing his own thing and running his own business, I felt very lucky and privileged to have him on the weekends. And he was a project guy. So no matter where we were, this has always been him to this day. He's got a project, some home improvement thing, working on the car, or we had a great church community that we were a part of. And they're always rehabbing this like 1900s church. It was old, big cobblestone building. The community that went to that church was all architects and guys that worked at the Jet Propulsion Lab for NASA, you know, that was like down the street. So they were constantly rehabbing this property, the church. And that was something that the kids got pulled into. I instantly enjoyed that time with my dad and the idea of having these little projects and these goals and building something and seeing your effects on something, especially something with your hands. So that was really fun times and good memories for me. You know, other than that, my memories of my father and his entrepreneurial track are full of peaks and valleys, ups and downs, and from having office to not having office to literally turning their bedroom into the office with these computers that were size of refrigerators. And then something would go well and, hey, guess what? We have an office again, kids, and come check it out. We're moving in. Another project, right? We got to set up the office. They were very busy people. My father worked many late nights, and my mother raised the kids, and then she would spend her time at the office with my dad running the business side of it, all that messy bookkeeping and all that stuff that it takes to keep a business going. So,
yeah, obvious connections between the nature of the work that you do, even though it's very different in terms of industry. But I see clear connections between the independent entrepreneurial pursuits, the ebbs and flows of seasons and events and how things play, and this perpetual hunt of the next connection, the next partnership, the next collaboration.
Yep.
And then also the fact that your partner in this is also, you know, your life partner outside of work. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. To fast forward today, I'm so fortunate that I found somebody that has that similar work ethic and very much reminds me of that relationship between my father and mother. It feels really good. It feels really natural. And my mother is no longer with us, but I often wish I could share this part of my life with her right now to just like ask her advice. How'd you and dad get through that? How did you guys navigate personal when your business is with your partner as well? There's a lot wrapped up in all that, obviously. But I'm so fortunate to have somebody that we see alike, we support each other, we're fans of each other, we like how the other one works. So we're a good yin and yang, and people pick up on that chemistry. So in our events world where hospitality and how you make people feel pays dividends, and people pick up on it. So I'm very fortunate about that. I think my father and mother had that same chemistry. It was always kind of fun to watch from afar. So I guess I had my clear picture cut out for me from day one. I just didn't really know it.
How would you characterize the relationship that you had with your dad?
Well, mom was the pillar of strength in the family. And both of my parents had come from previous marriages. I think that they had figured out a lot about themselves personally. So when they came together, they were both striving to be the best versions of themselves. And had, you know, already made some mistakes in life, whether, you know, that was mistakes they made or just the way life applies itself to your situation sometimes. So I feel like I'm at a similar point in my life where I've learned a lot, I've been through a lot, and I'm just trying to do my best right now. And I'm doing it with a partner who's doing the same. And that is important that we reflect that or try to project that to my girls. And that's something that is a conscious thought now. So I always felt that my mom and dad were trying to do the best they could by their kids. And I'm just super grateful for that. And I know it was hard for them as business owners and entrepreneurs that have to negotiate these ups and downs of being an entrepreneur, but they never made us feel like, oh, feel sorry for me, or it sucks because this is the life we've chosen. Because when you're a kid, you don't have a choice in the matter. So it's not, I don't think that's fair. Again, they never let on to how crazy and hectic and tight things got, how bad it got. They always just tried to promote this optimistic outlook. That said, I never thought it was like false optimism, because I've also seen that from other friends of mine who's, you know, who come from entrepreneur families. And I think sometimes that gets people in trouble. But I don't know if you ever did this when you're a kid, but I was always telling myself, when I'm an adult, I'm never going to forget this time, how I felt, so I can do better than my parents did. Now I'm finding myself asking my 9-year-old self, what was that thing that was going through at that time? What was that like? Which is really funny. It's probably putting like way too much pressure on myself. But at the same time, I try to reference it. And I hope that that's me being true to myself, at least my 9-year-old self.
Yeah, that's what all those embarrassing, mortifying journal entries are for, right? You dig back into those childhood diaries and you're like, oh my God, I was so dramatic. What was I doing?
Right. Yeah. But that's the way it feels at that time, you know? So I'm starting to be conscious of that with my 9-year-old daughter, but it's also frightening. I'm like, wow, you know, I could get really dramatic, or I could be in a really dark place in that like early preteen and teen time. So that is an age I'm not looking forward to, but I'm just going to try to approach it with as much open-mindedness and try to remember how I felt. So I think that's what it's going to come down to, is putting yourself in those shoes again is the best way I can think of navigating those waters when it comes time.
Yeah. You said something that struck me in that, you know, it's unfair to burden your kids with the realities of the big adult choices you've made because they don't have a say in it. Yeah. And I'm glad you said that, because I catch myself and I really want to curb it because it isn't helpful. But, you know, there's moments when I'm explaining to Javier, who's almost 5, why I'm frustrated or stressed out. It might be something as simple as like, you know, Maris is out and I've got both kids.
Right.
And so I'll tell them, hey, tonight it's just me and you with Amaya. And so, you know, I'm going to need extra help and need you to be a good listener or whatever. And in the thick of it, I'll be so exasperated by, you know, whatever, some chaotic dinner or just something.
Yeah.
And he sees me like so, you know, vexed about it all. And I'll just kind of like unload on him like he's an adult or he's a peer. And I'll be like, you know how hard it is to be at home with the two of you guys and doing these things. And I'll just go on and on, you know, and I'm watching his face and he's sort of like, he wants to empathize, but these are also like big adult things that like, and so he's just sort of stuck there. And now I'm realizing like, it's not productive. He really can't help. It's just this little woe is me moment. And I'm like looking for moral support from my 5-year-old, who's kind of like, cool story, Dad. can I have dessert? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's funny. I can already tell that you and I probably approach parenting in the same way. Like, I treat both the girls very adult-like, only because they can handle it. Like, they are pretty mature for their age, emotionally mature. And so sometimes you do want to like just talk to them like adults and even about complex things. But then you find yourself going, wait a second, they're kids. They're not even 10. Okay. And then I go back and rethink it. But at the same time, I do feel like it's helping build empathy, or it's broadening their horizon in some way. Because, you know what, the adults at school treat them like kids. In a play setting, they're allowed to be kids, whatever. But your bond with your parent is somewhat different, especially, I think, in this modern age. It's okay, I think, to see your parent as a normal person. When I was growing up, your parents are superheroes. They're super people doing all this amazing stuff all the time. or at least that's the way I looked at my parents, is because they were so busy and they were always accomplishing something. It was always, we started here and then we'd finish and you'd get to see the result. So it felt like, wow, I'm not like that. I want to sit in my room and play Legos. I want to draw for 3 hours straight. I don't know, whatever. I think it's okay for our kids to see us as human beings that have some flaws, because I can remember one or two times to see my parents in a weak moment. And I thought that was such a crazy thing. It's like burned into my brain. I don't know which one is better.
Yeah. It stands out in contrast to their success and achievement and
yeah,
and everything else that you saw day to day as like these moments
yeah,
where they were just regular people struggling.
Yeah.
I'm curious, based on what your dad did, and you know, I'm just picturing these giant mainframe computers and like engineering and software in the 70s. How did that influence, or did it, your work ultimately? I know you went to school and studied film and these other more creative dimensions at Columbia.
Yeah, I feel like it did. I do feel grateful that I got to be around that technology. It was a great way for my mind to see how machines work. Machines are built with parts and gears, but they're nothing without the programming or someone manipulating them in some way. So I was always very interested in the process of how things were made or how things work. That is still with me today. And I guess a life of being an entrepreneur for me is always finding out how a business works. What are all the pieces and parts inside, and who or what makes it go, and who does it the best? And that's my eternal curiosity. And I can almost apply that to anything I'm interested in. And, you know, the other side of that is anything in the house that I could find that had screws in it, I'd be like, Dad, where's your screwdriver? And I'd be taking apart our digital alarm clock or like the rotary telephone, and I'd take it apart. And, you know, my parents come in and be like, what did you do? How are you going to get that back together? And that was always my challenge. I'm like, oh, you don't think I can put that back together? So, you know, they were probably annoyed and also proud at the same time. You know, I'd say that that kind of translated to growing up in Southern California. We got to see the behind the scenes of filmmaking, you know, in town and around town. Once I realized that these movies that I watched on TV were communities of people that build these episodic programs, all that just piqued my interest, like the behind the scenes of it. And I realized there's a creative ecosystem where people create stories for people to consume. And it's a business. It's a huge business. And that always stuck with me. And I'd say everything I've been doing since high school has been to pursue a life in the collaborative creative fields, storytelling and experiences.
I think it's funny. You grew up in California. You've got Hollywood and Los Angeles. I
mean, yeah.
Wow. You come to Chicago to study film. It's kind of funny to me.
Yeah. Well, that again goes back to the choices that you have to make as an adult and how it affects your kids. So in the late 80s, my dad got a opportunity from Humana Healthcare to be acquired by them to start a new business. So accepting that opportunity came moving the whole family to Louisville, Kentucky. I remember the night crystal clear at the dinner table, me, my two sisters, my mom at the other head of the table. My dad said, what would you guys think if we moved to Louisville, Kentucky? My sisters and I all looked at each other like, where is that? Is that in the United States? You know, we were like, what? Why? Why would we move? We live in paradise, palm trees and mountains. And obviously my dad had to make a hard choice there. And we've talked about it many times since, you know, adult decisions come with a heavy burden. Again, he had to make the best decision he thought for his family. We moved to Louisville, Kentucky. It was like the start of my freshman year of high school. And I couldn't be more bitter about it at the time. It was like a huge disruption to my life. But it turned out to be a great opportunity for the family. That new business was wildly successful. And I think a beautiful, perfect next chapter for my father and his career and what he wanted to accomplish in life. So And in the end, it was the reason I came to Chicago, and it's probably the reason that I am the person I am today. It rounded me out, gave me a new perspective, and I really could all of a sudden appreciate another side of life. I was all of a sudden very intrigued by, there's a whole country outside of Los Angeles, California, with all these different states, all these different people, all these different point of views, different architecture, different cultural upbringings. And that was probably one of the best things to happen to me as a child, even though at the time I hated it.
Yeah, I hear you, man. I moved to Atlanta between my sophomore and junior year of high school after living in a Chicago suburb for 16 years. And the culture shock, leaving the Midwest and going down to the South, that moment in time, high school is just turbulent it is. And then you lose every connection you've ever had, every friendship. Yeah. And all of a sudden you're you're in this place and people talk different and every single part of it felt alien.
That is a great way to describe it. That was me for sure. I'm going back to California as soon as I can. I'm going to move out. You know, it seems like this very rebellious backlash to the situation that your parents just applied to you. And going through that time in my life, I was taking risks that I would never normally take, but it was truly just a rebellious stage in my life. It also helped me say, maybe I do have this air of creativity. Maybe I should focus on the arts as a career, because I kind of thought maybe I should do stuff like my dad with computers and tech, and which I was interested enough in, but I also had that behind the scenes of filmmaking and storytelling and something that could impact people in a visual audio way was also nagging at me. So luckily enough, mom and dad took us on a road trip once or twice to Chicago. It was close. It was easy enough. And I'd never seen architecture like Chicago before in my life. I just kept finding other layers of Chicago that were interesting to me. The elevated train and the neighborhoods and these little storefronts. And it was like, it just had heart and soul. Like Chicago seemed to have a little bit of everything. And at the time too, there was this emerging indie rock scene that was coming up out of Chicago. And it was like, wait, these kids are doing what they want to do. They're creating this music. It's not on the radio. I'm getting tapes on cassettes of this bands called like the Sea and Cake and the Jesus Lizard and Smashing Pumpkins in Louisville, Kentucky. And, you know, that was amazing to me because growing up in California, it's like everybody wanted to have their garage band and do their tape, and it gets in the hands of a record producer and then you're famous and you're on the radio. There was this whole different creative economy coming out of Chicago that I thought, wow, that's interesting. And then my mother, being as smart and in touch as she was like, oh, they have a film school there. And I was like, oh, interesting. Okay. So my dad and I come up on another trip solo and we go to Columbia College. And this is mid-90s, grunge is peaking. And we walk through these old buildings that are totally off base. My dad's like, where's the campus? You know, I, of course, loved it because I was like, this is the most anti-college experience ever. My dad is shaking his head. He went to business school, but he's biting his tongue the whole time and never once kiboshing the idea. So first day of college started, I felt like I had just grown wings and I'm in a new city with new people surrounded by creative people that are way more creative than me, taking way bigger risks. My eyes were wide open. Like, what is life like here? What's going on in the creative scene? What are young people doing? How are they making an impact? I had a new muse, and the city was the muse. And at that time, like, hip hop music was becoming big. And I realized, like, this is the most unique platforms of storytelling of current pop culture. These guys are telling a story about their real life and they're making money off of it. They're documenting their struggles, and the way that they're telling the story is glorifying it, and people are eating it up. It's the biggest coup in pop culture. Being at Columbia, I'm obviously in this new urban environment, and, you know, halfway through my sophomore year, opened a recording studio with a guy I met at Columbia. And once we embraced that Columbia College hip hop community, we were off to the races. It was a very interesting time in life, let's just say.
Yeah. How do you fund a music studio when you're in college?
This is a great story. So I got lucky enough to be paired up in a dorm with this individual. You know, we obviously spent a lot of time together. It was like the coldest winter in Chicago that they'd had in 20 years. So we're stuck in this building with a bunch of crazy college kids. Like, people had full-on band practice spaces in their dorm rooms and photography setups. And it was really a crazy, like, compound of kinetic creative energy. But him and I, both children of entrepreneurial families, and we dreamt up this idea. We went back on a college break and we said, we got to pitch this to our dad. So we put together this little proposal and like a little binder and pitched this whole thing and talked to our parents about how hip hop is the newest thing on the music scene and digital recording is right around the corner. So of course, both our fathers were into that, the innovation side of it. So long story short, my father said to me, if you can raise half the funds that you're saying you need to open this, then I will match it. So I came back from break, you know, back with my roommate, Greg, and we're like, here's what my dad said. And Greg's like, my dad basically said the same thing. I was like, well, then we're there. You know, we go back and, you know, we said, we have these funds committed and these funds committed. Is that good enough? We get our fathers on the phone together. And they're probably like, yeah, these knuckleheads are like not going to shut up until we do this. So they helped us start it. And then my partner and I went out looking for a space. We're looking through the paper and visiting these storefronts all around Chicago and these neighborhoods we've never been to before, but it was a really fun, exciting time. And we found this one building that used to be like a storefront. There was a shop downstairs and this is the second level. Great old concrete building that built like a factory. And we're walking through with the landlord. We're way out of our league, right? We look like grungy art school kids. And the guy showing us the property happened to be the building owner. And he's like, did I hear you guys are wanting to do a recording studio? And we're like, oh, shit, this is where this conversation is going to end, right? This guy doesn't want a bunch of college kids banging on drums in his building. He goes, hold on a second. Let me do something. He goes, he leaves for a minute. Turns out he goes upstairs, comes back down and says, guys, I want to show you something. He takes us to the third floor and there's the most amazing independent recording studio built into the third floor of this building. At the time, it was like a recording studio for the Chicago industrial bands that were popular at the time. And we were blown away. Just like, wow, what is this guy up to? Who is this guy? He ends up matching our funds to build out the space. Cause he's like, if you're going to do it, you have to build it out. Like, you guys got to be kidding me. And so I'll do that. We'll tack it on the lease. We'll do a short lease, 3 years and, you know, go for it. We were like, wow. So all of it happened very fortunate. I have no idea why people were open to this idea coming from these two silly white boys, but it was maybe just the spark in our eye. I don't know. I think, I'm very fortunate to have people take a chance on us. So we go back to our fathers. Both of our fathers played a big role. My dad came up for like a week and helped us like swing a hammer. You know, we had to build out these recording rooms with drywall and floating floors. And it was a mess. And I was going to class, like, you know, falling asleep because we'd stayed up till 4 a.m. building this thing out with just like, you know, friends and definitely not professional contractor types. And, it was fun. It was the most exhilarating time, but the most exhausting time. And now we actually had to operate it. It's funny how I've learned over my career. It's like concepting is one thing, building is another thing, and then operating it, that's the real hard part. It's like you think every time you transcend one of those summits, you're like, okay, I've made it, done, open the doors, and then it's just golden. But then it's like, that's when the real hard work starts. So we operated for 3 years, gave it away for the first year. And then the next 2 years, we made money. We paid off everything. We paid down everything. And the building owner sold the building, which was the best gift in life because my business partner and I were sick of each other at that point. We were working 20 hours a day. We were trying to actually finish a degree at school and trying to live normal lives of early 20-somethings. And we couldn't anymore. We had to work, you know, friends are going out to bars and going on trips, and we're like, now we got to work. It wasn't that fun at that time. You know, it was kind of like, oh, this is cool. But now we've like built our own jail and we live in it 20 hours a day. You know, and my poor business partner, he was the engineer. So he was like stuck in the room with these people hours upon hours upon hours. And he was very talented, the most amazing work ethic, like tireless dude. But at the end of our 3-year run, we were exhausted. It was a perfect time to wrap that up and say, wow, that was fun. It was an experience. And we went on to the next thing.
Yeah. How did you go from studying film and being at Columbia and running a music studio and all of these things to the kind of work that you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, obviously I was going to film school, and in the midst of doing all that, I was a volunteered hire on any student film I could jump on board on. I basically said to myself, if I try every role, then I'll find the role that I like best. I kind of felt as I was going that a producer role was a good fit for me. Again, like seeing all the pieces and then putting all the pieces together for that final complete piece. That was very satisfying to me, but I was like, I'll do anything. I'll pull cable to, you know, camera assistant to a director's assistant to, I did the lighting, the sound. I played a role on every trades team and found out, you know, the thing that interests me the most is finding the best in each trade, putting them together for one. So I started doing music videos for artists in the studio. And because I was doing that, I got to meet people that were actually really doing that work in the city. And their other business, when they weren't doing music videos, was commercial work. So I kept my little music video team going, running around town, doing videos for a couple $1,000 and paying people a couple $100 in pizza and beer. And when the studio wrapped up, it was like, okay, now I need to turn this multimedia thing into a full-time thing or go work for somebody. So I just kept that video work up as much as I could and hawking myself out to whoever would want to hire me. I was a consultant and I got to work under some really amazing people and on occasion, you know, work on a nice film or independent film. All that was exciting. But one day I had a guy from an agency call me who had turned out to be a real interesting dude and kept popping up in my life. And he challenged me to put together an experiential marketing event. That was the buzzword of the day. The new marketing is experiential marketing. And, you know, I got a download on what he was looking for. I'm like, this is no different than what I do producing a video project, except there's actually a hard end date, which I loved as well. You know, there's nothing worse than like shooting something or recording something and having to go back for a retake or a reshoot, or that part felt so inefficient and so brutal. So I did this one event and then I realized that is the work for me. If I can find out how to do experiential events for brands or for creative endeavors, that's going to be the most satisfying work for me. So in short, that's kind of how I started along that track. And then everything I've done since then has been an attempt to stay in that lane and in that business.
Yeah. It appears you have like 5 or 6 lanes in that industry. Like you've got, you know, multiple enterprises that have a nuance to each of them, right?
Yeah.
Could you quickly run through like this business operates for this purpose?
Yeah.
This one here is all about this. Like what's the breakdown for you? Cause it seems like a lot of things in motion.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the end of the day, my tangible widget is not that tangible really. It's creating experiences and memories. To that end, the businesses are ESP Presents, which is an experiential marketing company. We're a little different in the way that we do stuff for brands. And we also, probably more than 50% of our clients are not-for-profit organizations. So we help them with their fundraising and educational events and that kind of stuff. So spreading the word. And then the Chop Shop Chicago, which is a 15,000 square foot venue. So that was my desire to be in the hospitality world, which has always been something that's been important to me. And I've always loved that business as a whole, from restaurants to hotels to just always been fascinated by that whole industry. So it's a bar, restaurant, and music venue. And then our newest venue is Exchange 312, which is an intimate, high-end event space. The idea behind it is to create a community hub that provides a place for work and play. And hopefully builds a ecosystem of users that maybe support the creative and hospitality industry. And then I'm working on a auction package company that is basically creating experiences that include travel, food, and community experiences that we can package for charities to sell to their donors. Like I said, all to go back to, so I can have a hand in creating experiences and memories for people that are long lasting and maybe transformative, if I could be so bold to say that.
You know, I know all of these things didn't just sprout up at once. They're mounting, and it seems like you see an opportunity where there isn't a thing or not a satisfactory thing. And so you say, oh, I'm going to make a new thing here. I'm going to bring another enterprise online, and it's going to focus on this facet or this dimension, all like you've said, around making memories and experiences for people and creating these sort of moments or events. But somewhere in there, you learn that you are going to have a child. And I know that was about 9 years ago, but take me back to that moment where you're in the thick of things, entrepreneurial as hell, making these businesses happen. And then you learn this new news.
Well, I hope that I don't embarrass myself, but I thought, well, my current superhero life will come to an end. Like, I'll just have to conform to normal day-to-day existence because there's no way all these things can exist at the same time. That thought was fighting with the other side of me saying, oh, I can do anything. But the other side was winning more. I was like, there's no way. Like, you're going to kill yourself, burn out, go down in flames. Is basically where my head went. And I think that might be normal for men to panic at the thought of being a new father. And the only thing I could do is wake up in the morning and be like, you know, you got this. You're going to make it work. You just got to face it. I remember one thing my parents used to say is that there's never going to be a good time to have kids. You're never going to say, oh, this is the perfect time to have kids. At least that was their point of view. And that was their way of saying, like, when it happens, when it presents itself, you just do it and you figure it out. So I kind of had that, you know, in the back of my head, but still I was panicking. Just talking about it, it's like I can almost bring it back up, you know. And I also just thought, how am I going to survive? At the time, I was growing a business, and luckily I had a partner at the time who was also in television production, that world. She understood the hours, but, you know, we were working long, long hours and networking 3 nights a week, and then starting at 7 a.m., sometimes, you know, being on site for 10, 12, still have a whole day in the office you have to catch up at home. It was a really hectic time, but I was young and I was like, as long as I work harder than the next guy, I'm going to grow faster and it's going to be great. But then with the child coming, I was like, there's no way I can keep up that pace. And therefore, the business is going to suffer, right? I couldn't see a way around it. So then it happened, and I was halfway surprised that my worst fears were not totally unwarranted. Some people were not happy with me taking time off to be a dad. Or, like, I remember being super stressed out that clients were calling me, really adamant that they needed something from me when I was, like, at the hospital with my wife, with my new baby. It kind of jaded me in a way that I still remember. But that also inspired me to live a different way and build a new life around myself, that I have more control and I'm not at the mercy of the clients that I support, which, again, it pushed me into that. And only now I can say I'm better for that. And I figured it out. It forced me to make a choice, right? To say, you have to focus on family or that's going to be a mess, or you take your eye off work. There's always going to be someone that's not satisfied. So you're going to have to pick one. And me being someone who likes to make everybody happy, and I can do that and do that, it was hard for me to swallow that reality. But it very much humanized me, and realized, I'm like, wow, all I could think about were my parents. Like, how did they do it? And they had 3 kids.
Yeah, I feel like in that industry, in that world where you're making things happen and you're coordinating stuff as a producer, and you're bringing together all these different talents to pull a thing off, the demand on your time as just, like, convener of skills and talents for this very specific thing, right? Like, yeah. those dates, when they're set, they don't budge. Everybody has been working towards whatever it is.
Yeah.
and you're in hospitality, which is like, you know, you can't be more in service of people and their feelings.
Right.
Besides like hospitality and therapy, you know? Yep.
Exactly right.
And so, you know, people are on the other end like, yeah, that's good. Congratulations. You're having a baby. What about my event and pulling all of these things together in time?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You said things changed sort of evaluating these commitments and what you're doing and building this up. What stayed the same about your practice or your approach to the business? And what did you say had to change?
The major pivot was to say, you know, I work so much, I make decent money, like let's invest in something that can be the next chapter. So identify what that is. And I was like, I want to be in the hospitality business now, host people and have people over to my place and all that stuff, which is insane when I'm already giving 20 hours of my day to everybody else. But that's just an innate desire. And I feel like every 6 or 7 years, I just need to indulge in those things, to cross it off the list or to say I tried that because it interests me. So that was the motivation behind the Chop Shop. And I thought I could do both things, but that came with a huge amount of pressure. And I had basically started a village full of fires. And then my partner and I found out she's pregnant again, which then I was, for some reason, really excited. I was like, wow, well, that's crazy. But it just reinforced the thought in my head, like, okay, it's time to make a change. Like, your life is going to change. You might as well embrace it and build the next chapter, build the new vessel in a way that you want. So those two coming together with child number two coming and building a new business, it was, I just had to look at it like, okay, this is, you're creating your next chapter. So
what do you think the difference was? The news of your first daughter, like you said, for many men, that's sort of terrifying to learn that. And then you instantly start rushing through like all the things that you're just going to have to put on pause. Like there's just no way I can balance all these things. Everything's right. Got to stop. I got to like hunker down and prepare.
Right.
And then only 14 months later, you know, barely a year into fatherhood and being a dad. And then you're super pumped and you're like embracing it. Besides a year of learning, like anything else that you would attribute to those two very different reactions to essentially the same news, like we're pregnant?
After year one, you know, it's like year one is like boot camp. And you get through year one and you're like, wow, I've survived. I'm still here. I'm intact. I'm actually the same person inside. I just actually might have grown a new empathy and self-awareness and all this stuff. So it was just getting through that first year and my own surprise that I survived. And also felt like these two little humans were going to be great friends. I'm not saying it like took pressure off of me, but in a way, I just felt like for some reason they're going to be better as a pair than solo. I don't know, it motivated me to look at it a different way. Don't look at, oh, now it's going to be twice as hard. Just embrace it and give it all you got because these two being so close together are going to make a great pair.
And what was the timing? When did you arrive at this realization that you needed to end the relationship with your daughter's mom?
You know, unfortunately, during the time of Lainey's birth, my first daughter, and the second, all of that stress and that garbage that I was putting on myself, you know, fully manifested itself in the worst way. And that took a toll on my relationship with their mom. I was doing so much. There were so many balls in the air. I was in the middle of so many relationships. You know, I was trying to just start up a new business that has partners, trying to wind down and out of another business with partners and relationships. And, you know, I have to admit that trying to do all that and be a dad or be around, I couldn't manage it. I didn't manage it well. And my relationship suffered. So we grew apart and a wedge had been clearly inserted, especially trying to start something new right at that time. That comes with so much risk, right? But I, you know, invited all that into our relationship at a very critical time. And I believe it hurt our relationship. So regretfully, that's the way it all played out. So starting the new business, winding down out of the other business, and having a new baby, and our relationship being on the rocks, was all just too much. So it was the right thing to do to split. But the one thing I'm most grateful for is that we always kept the kids in mind and said we will always put their interests and wants and their well-being first. As painful as separation is, all the stuff that comes with it, we can't let that ever cloud our judgment when it comes to the girls. So I'm very grateful and proud of how we've handled it. And obviously it takes a certain kind of person, and my former partner is that person. She's very strong and leads with integrity. And that's why we are such good co-parents today.
When we've talked in the past, you've said, you know, we have this unbroken bond in spite of our divorce or in spite of our separation, and that we could zoom out from ourselves as adults and set aside our adult feelings and focus on, you know, the needs of our daughters. And can you speak a bit about that?
I mean, I think that's exactly it. To make that commitment takes a lot of work, right? Because obviously we're adults with big grown adult feelings, and that's really hard to ignore. I guess all I can say is that, you know, it's gotten better over time. It's the best outcome we could have hoped for, you know.
How old were your daughters when you separated from their mom?
So they were about 3 and 4. And I remember that being, you know, a topic that their mom and I were talking about. And in a way, we said, you know, if this is how we feel now, you know, some people hold on just for the kids, or some people wait till the kids go off to college. So in our discussions about separation, it was like, maybe they're so young that they won't know another way. They won't remember the old times and have a whole sentimental outlook on it. They'll remember, but when you're kids, I mean, how far back can you remember? And, you know, there's also the other side of the coin. Like, if we're not happy, how does that benefit anyone, either of us and or the children, by staying together under false pretenses? You know, that's not being true. And so that was a contributing factor, I think, was how young they were.
How often do you see them?
Right now we're in about every other day regimen. Like I said, I'm very fortunate to have a co-parent who understands the nature of my business, and I understand hers. So we do about an every other day kind of thing, like Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And so it's like one of us is dropping them off at school in the morning and the other is picking up at night. And then we coordinate trips and long weekends and little one-off events as they come up. Like I said, her and I are very good at logistics, the two of us. We always have been. So we plan these things out a month in advance, and calendar work is strong. And we set the expectation on all fronts that way, and it seems to really work.
Any tips for making memories or creating experiences? I mean, you do it every day for clients and for creative and celebrity types and interesting organizations. And then there's your kid's own life. How do you make that happen? Or how do you at least keep it at the forefront or top of mind?
Yeah, this is an interesting question, because I'm probably constantly judging myself on that. Like, how do I show up that way for my girls? And it's hard. It's hard when I do it every day for everybody else to turn it back on myself and my family. I realize that. I feel like that's something where I really need to improve on. Well, my current life and parenting situation has forced upon me is to be in the moment more and be more present. When I'm carving out family time on the calendar, which is how it's done 100% of the time in my kind of modern family scenario, then I literally just try to focus on that. I'm not on the phone. I'm not taking other meetings. Sometimes those things creep in together. And when they do, I try to incorporate the girls in it somehow, or, you know, show them the nuances of how this event is going down. If they decide to come and look at a site with me, or preview an event before it starts, or meet a principal of an organization, then I just enroll them in it and tell them why I'm doing that work and what I'm doing for those people. I hope that that's creating some memories in itself. I think it's always fun to see what your parents are up to, or at least it was for me when I was a kid, to see my parents in their place of business doing what they do best. You know, now I try to focus on stuff that is starting to create a tradition. You know, that's easy to do around seasons. Some of my best memories of the holidays, like cooking together as a family, going to pick up the Christmas tree, or those kind of traditions, I think really stuck with me. And I can tell that my oldest daughter has that tendency as well. She brings things up, you know, she'll say, hey, can we do that again? And I love that. So that's obviously, I take that cue and I try to run with it. You know, I also don't want to be that parent who throws the most elaborate party for their kid's birthday every year. I'm not that guy. I can't be. That's the last thing I want for the girls. So it's tough. And I judge myself on that pretty harshly constantly. But in my little way, it's about being in the moment and then pointing out interesting behind the scenes things to the girls while we're doing it. Because I think that's piquing their creativity, piquing their curiosity. And it's fun because now they will repeat back stuff to me that they pick up when they're in a moment. And that means a lot to me.
Yeah, I was going to ask, have they exhibited at 8 and 9 any tendencies towards your line of work?
A little bit. Yeah, they'll often create little shops or stores or a beauty shop. They did this big old fashion show in the apartment the other day that I was pretty proud of. So I don't know where that's coming from. I'm not forcing it on them, but it's pretty fun to see.
I'll look at a day and instead of playing out like all the highlight reel of like, oh, and then there was that moment and there's that funny thing we did. And I'll just kind of end the day with like, oh man, I could have done that better. I don't know why we got into that little fight about something so silly, or like, you know, why did I bark at him about that? Like, I just kind of play back like the low moment, yeah. You know, and I just feel like, oh, it's so frustrating when I look at time and I think, my goodness, like we waste a lot of energy and time in negotiating around things and the everyday mundane stuff. And I would feel that if you don't have your kids all the time, that the time you do have sort of ratchets up in its preciousness. And I would just feel this tension around like, we can't waste any energy on like mundane everyday argument kind of stuff. Like we can only have fun. Like, yeah. How do we maximize fun? Yeah. And that's probably unrealistic because
it is.
Even if you see your kids Monday, Wednesday, Fridays and long weekends, like,
yeah,
everyday annoying things still fill those spaces.
Yeah, absolutely. I find myself beating myself up over those little things as well, because I do try to approach it from the mindset of, well, I only have this much time, so let me maximize it. In a way, that's the best reminder, right? Like if you're training or running, you know, you're kind of talking to yourself to get through to the end. I have to keep reminding myself about that, which is helpful. And I think it's produced great results. But of course, you can't help, you know, the BS from seeping into your life no matter what. And then I will get frustrated about that happening. And then sometimes, you know, that gets projected onto the girls. And I always regret that and beat myself up about it. But then I go, or I have someone around me, like my partner Sarah, is just like, that is life. Like, not everything can be the best day ever. And I'm grateful for her to kind of remind me of that, because I do get into my head sometimes about, what are they experiencing right now? What are they going to remember about tonight? It's a Tuesday night in the middle of the school year. What they should remember is
their homework,
work, dinner, you know, tea, pajamas, bed. And then sometimes that bums me out. I'm like, oh, that's all the time I got with them was a dinner time, bedtime, and then off to school in the morning. But at the same time, that does help me focus on that time being as good as it can be. There's no reason to argue. Just dive in as much as possible, even if they're annoyed. You know, hey, what'd you do today? What'd you eat today? What's something funny that your friend told you today? I try to dive in when I can, because those hours are so few and far between. And right now they're at an age where we can have some really fun conversations about that kind of stuff, and screens and their outside lives don't invade too often when it's our time.
I'm curious, looking back now, what advice you would offer to someone who is at that crossroads, who is questioning beyond just sort of everyday frustrations that happen in relationships, like whether they're with the right person and whether staying in it, quote unquote, for the sake of the kids or to not disrupt their world or, you know, all the things that we begin to rationalize around a big disruptive decision like that to like end a relationship or divorce or separate or whatever. Now that you've had time to sort of live with it and learn from it, what would you suggest to both parties for how to maybe begin to think through that or to come to grips with like, yeah, this isn't a thing we're going to solve with therapy. This is something else.
Well, I'll tell you, obviously, probably the hardest decision I've made in my life. And what it came down to was choosing your own happiness or making the choice that you're okay with not being 100% happy for these other reasons. I feel like I don't want it to sound selfish, but at the same time, that's all you have. And you have to come back to yourself and be true to yourself. And you got to be happy with yourself and love yourself enough to choose your happiness. And that's a really hard thing to do when there's all these other factors in play, especially the way we build our lives up. But that's what it came down to. And if you can make that decision and respect all the other parts of your life the right way, then you can probably make it out the other side. And both sides are going to be happy with the outcome. And sometimes these families can blend together. You're starting to see that more and more, even post-separation, and people get remarried and they have kids in common. Sometimes those families blend together for gatherings and occasions, and that's happening now with us to support the girls. It always comes back to them. And that's really cool. I mean, that's how it should be. That's what we committed to, and we're trying to live into that.
Yeah, I'm sure that's not easy to do.
It's not, and it takes time. At the same time, if you committed to the girls and it's about them, then at least you have that purpose, and it's a shared purpose, which by executing well, you actually start to build bond, or at least it's trust. Like, I have nothing but confidence that the girl's mom has nothing but their best interest in mind. I'm pretty sure she feels the same about me. So that's a bond in itself.
As a creative person, as a producer, someone who drags entire experiences into being and pulls all this talent together to make it possible, create space, does all of that kind of work make you a better or worse dad for your girls?
I would like to think that it makes it better, because I think there's a real beauty in gathering people together. To me, there's nothing more satisfying than being able to change someone's mood or feeling about something with an experience, by what they're experiencing in the moment. You can read people really well. You kind of have to. I think musicians have that innate sense as well. And I feel like that's a great thing to promote or to try to bring to the surface for them to observe, because that can only benefit or increase their emotional intelligence, empathy for people around them. And I personally love passing down the little nuggets of hospitality, what good hospitality is and what it's like to host people in your space and offer these little courtesies to people that make them feel special. I notice that they think that's pretty cool too. So that's kind of a fun thing to pass on. Probably translates to any business or any industry that they're into. And I think that's a life lesson that doesn't go away.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell Podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a review on iTunes. As a new podcast, this helps a ton and would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks, so visit dadwell.co to find links to all of those. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter, check out some helpful resources and books, and even cop some fresh Dadwell merchandise. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks so much for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.